Accession number 18801, Reel 2.
Mr. Victor May, Reel 2.
During our spell in Deal, our men on coast defence had noticed a small aircraft known as a Lysander flying regularly about midday up the coast from south to north. And they got so used to this plane, and they waved to the pilot, and the pilot waved back to them. And one day we thought we would just check up on this plane to see where he came from, what he was doing. And there was no British plane at that time flying up and down the coast. That plane had been captured by the Germans in France and was being used by the Germans to observe our coast defences and probably take photographs of our coast defences. So the next time he came, he had a burst of machine gun, and then he never came back again. Now, November 1940, after a short spell in Deal, the Britannia was moved northwards to the North Kent coast. We were then responsible for the coast defence from Seasalter near Whitstable to Rakova, which was getting on towards Broadstairs or Ramsgate. Battalion headquarters was at Herne Bay College, which still continued to function as a boys' college, although the sleeping quarters had been taken over by the army. It had an engineering bias, and some of its pre-war students came from Germany and Czechoslovakia. If an enemy plane flew low overhead, the headmaster, his name was Turner, I believe, said one of his old boys had returned, and he was even tempted to go out and wave to his old boys flying Messerschmitts or such like in greeting. Well, there was a great deal of aerial activity at that time. There were sort of dogfights between Spitfires and Hurricanes and German planes, leaving vapor trails in the sky. I'd never seen vapor trails before. All sorts of interesting patterns. There were also shipping convoys out in the Thames estuary going in and out of London, and some of those were many of those were bombed from time to time. In December 1940, the air war continued, and while London was being bombed, we could actually see the glow of the fires of London in the sky, even though it was 40, 50 miles away. Christmas Day 1940, I manned the telephone exchange while my signallers had their Christmas dinner. It was the custom that officers would either wait on the troops at Christmas time or they would take over some of the troops' duties. That Christmas, I was on the telephone exchange. I received a very tedious greetings message by Morse code, which I later discovered was sent by the brigade signals officer, who was likewise employed on his telephone exchange. The blitz on London continued, and the returning bombers sometimes offloaded unused bombs indiscriminately over Kent. And I recall one night, while checking on our defensive positions, hearing a low whistling sound as a cluster of bombs was falling. I took cover with Major Taylor, my company commander, between a concrete obstacle and a railway bridge, and the bomb was dropped not so far off, but no casualties, fortunately. And the red glow in the western sky indicated London's fire continuing. There were also odd bombs on the Isle of Sheppey. Sheerness was a sort of minor naval base, I understand. January 41 was extremely cold, much snow. I tried the signals dispatch rider motorcycle on packed smooth snow. I fell off at first, but eventually I managed to ride motorcycles on packed snow. If there was a very foggy night and still, then we had to stand to. The idea of a stand to was that all the troops on the forward positions on the coast were then actually awake with their rifles and ammunition, on the alert in case of any German landings. Occasionally, one had heard in Deal and in Herne Bay sort of pop, pop, pop noises, as though there were German motorboats exploring the sea, off the sea, to see what the response would be. But we were never aware of any German landing in that time. February 41, they decided that the battalion should leave the French, the Kent coast, and move north to the East Riding of Yorkshire. So the whole battalion had to entrain on a very long, slow journey, mostly at night, with frequent stops. We went from Herne Bay to Hornsey in East Yorkshire. Headquarters then was at Wasson Hall, a big country mansion near Hornsey, and my signals headquarters was based there at first. My job then was keeping the companies in contact with headquarters by army phone, and we required some rather ancient radios known as number 8 sets, and we were able to use radio sets as well. We were responsible for the coast from, I would say, Withernsea up to almost Bridlington. So we had three companies out on the coast, and one in reserve, and headquarters, and all the specialists in reserve. Very tedious and very boring, but nevertheless it was a job that had to be done, because it was the second most likely coast for a German landing, so they said. They thought one possible landing area was East Riding of Yorkshire, and then the Germans would aim inland and make a big headquarters in York. That seemed to be the likely plan. But again, it never came off. Even while we were there, we were still bombed. The local gasworks was bombed and the gasometer was put out of action. I saw a German plane shoot up the front in Hornsey in the Flora Gardens, and I saw a poor lady dive for cover as the German bullets were striking the grass almost in front of her, but she wasn't injured, fortunately. And we did the run there for quite a few months, I think. But in April 1942, I was appointed Brigade Intelligence Officer with the rank of Captain. And the Brigade Headquarters was inland from Hornsey at a little place called Leven. And one of my duties then, apart from passing information to all the battalions, the three battalions, was to ensure that the minefields which had been laid were charted. On a flat section of coast, like the landing ground, there was tubular scaffolding erected to delay landing craft, and there were anti-personnel and anti-vehicle mines laid to discourage landings. But all these mines had to be pinpointed very carefully on maps. And there were, as far as I remember, there were three maps of minefields, three copies of each map. One held by the battalion at the time, one I think stayed with the local Home Guard, and one went inland to the local headquarters, the divisional headquarters, which I think was in York. There were three battalions in our brigade: 11th Battalion Gloucestershire Regiment, based in Bridlington, 10th Duke of Wellington Regiment on Withernsey, and the 7th KSLI Hornsey. And we were responsible for the whole coast from Spurn Point, the mouth of the Humber, right up to Filey, over 50 miles of coastline, much of it flat, and the second most probable landing site for German troops. In April, I was then sent on a war intelligence course at Matlock in Derbyshire, which I survived and came out qualified as a brigade intelligence officer, with a remark, a good type of young officer who's worked well and shows confidence and ability. June 42, the brigade moved inland to Otley, northwest of Leeds, for training, a training camp. Because on coast defence, not too much exercise. Mostly it was sort of standing in horrid, damp pill boxes, or physicians looking vaguely out to sea or looking at the sky. And they were lacking training and exercise. So the whole brigade moved to Otley, northwest of Leeds, in a training camp. And our coastal duties were taken over by the 2nd Division, who were later to go to Burma. So we had a pleasant summer under canvas, not too strenuous, and after a few weeks back to Leven again. July 42, they decided to move us up to the Tees Mouth. Brigade headquarters then was at Wynyard Hall, which was owned by the Marquess of Londonderry. It was west of Stockton-on-Tees. We were then responsible for coast defence at the mouth of the Tees from West Hartlepool to southwards to Saltburn. Part of our defence was to man odd pillboxes, and one of the pillboxes near West Hartlepool was known as the Whizzer. It seems rather strange. It was a concrete pillbox that had been painted on the seafront to look exactly like a child's roundabout, and with a little roof. And the idea was to deceive the Germans into thinking this was part of an amusement park, and if they came, that would be quite harmless. But in fact, it was manned with a platoon of infantry with machine guns. That was known as the Whizzer at Seaton Carew, just outside Hartlepool. Now, at Teesmouth, the ICI works at Billingham were in full blast, presumably making maybe poison gas, mustard gas, explosives. I don't know, I have no idea what they were making, but it was regarded as a very vulnerable site. Because of that, it was covered by smoke screens at night. Horrible smoking lamps were placed in the streets around Billingham, and they were lit every evening, and they belched forth dense black smoke to deceive the enemy, presumably, into thinking that Billingham was elsewhere. And to carry on that deception, lights were placed in the countryside, including Wynyard Park, where we were based. The idea was to make the Germans feel that Billingham was in Wynyard Park, and they would drop their bombs on Wynyard accordingly. And so they did. The decoy lights in Wynyard attracted many bombs, and I was actually bombed in my room, and a skylight above my bed was shattered, and I was showered in broken glass as a result of a German bomb near Wynyard Hall. Well, as one can realise, coast defence was a very tedious thing for everybody involved, including the brigade intelligence officer. I had a cousin in the Wrens in West Hartlepool, and she was a friend of a minesweeper officer, and they decided that I could have a little trip on a minesweeper at sea. And I went on this minesweeper from West Hartlepool, having signed away my life, that if by chance I should be killed, the Navy would not be responsible, and my relations would not have any compensation. Well, being young and married and carefree, I signed the document and went aboard the minesweeper. There were 3 minesweepers sailing south from Hartlepool to Bridlington in a V formation. We just set sail when a convoy arrived, a convoy of ships sailing again from north to south. The minesweepers hadn't been told about this, about security, so they had to haul in the trawl, which was to sweep away the German mines, which had been attached by wires. They hauled in the trawl, they went to one side of the convoy passed through, then we started minesweeping again. Presumably, if there had been mines, the convoy would have hit the mines and not the minesweepers. But we had a pleasant little trip down to Bridlington Bay. During that time, one of the men on the minesweeper I was on was baiting hooks for fishing. His plan was that when they got to Bridlington Bay, a big line about 100 yards long, with a hook every yard, baited, was to be thrown out and floating, or on floats, and would catch fish, which it did. So the following morning I removed the fish and then started minesweeping back again from Bridlington to Hartlepool. And when we got back to Hartlepool, after a safe journey, instead of going ashore, they then celebrated their safe arrival by drinking gin and water, and I'm afraid I had too much gin, so that's another story. Now, November 1942, the brigade was disbanded, and the 7th KSLI, which was my old battalion, became the 99th Anti-Tank Regiment Royal Artillery. I was posted to the 2nd KSLI in Bridport in Dorset, but when I got to Bridport in Dorset, they didn't seem to have a room for me, they didn't have a job for me, so they warned me for overseas tropical duties, and I was sent on embarkation leave. I was one of a draft of infantry officers who assembled in the Hotel Great Central, Marylebone, near Marylebone Station. The code numbers, I think, were RBOZA and RBOZF. I think that's Reinforcement British Officers, ZAZF. And we had to report twice daily until eventually we boarded a train at Euston bound for Glasgow. And in the intervals between reporting, we were free to explore London, visit friends, relatives, go to cinemas, do what we like. As long as we reported twice a day, morning and evening, we were completely free to do what we liked. But on one of those reports, they then said, right, you're off, this is it. And we were warned to board a train at Euston, and we were sent off to Glasgow. This was about the 15th of January, 1943. Having got to Glasgow, we then were ferried out to a big liner called the Strathaiden, a P&O liner, which was moored in the Clyde. Well, a big convoy was assembling, and I felt rather guilty in a way, because as an officer, I was in a comfortable two-berth cabin with valves laid on, a cabin steward, wash basin, but the troops down below. And there were many decks down below, it went sort of B, C, D, I was on B deck, I think, right down to E, F, G, H decks. They had the most deplorable conditions, and there must have been 2,000 or 3,000 troops on that ship in the most really appalling conditions. Ghastly, I call it. And yet the officers were in comparative comfort. There was even a lift to take the officers from one deck to another in case by chance they couldn't manage the stairs, which seemed quite absurd. That was while it was moored in the Clyde. But when the convoy set sail, the lift was taken, was closed and locked up, and we sailed on the 18th of January, 43. Now, we had no idea where we were going to. We had tropical kit, Middle East, India, West Africa, East Africa, South Africa, nobody knew, complete secret. And because the Germans had been very active in the North Atlantic, this convoy with destroyer escort, and I think there was an aircraft carrier, sailed west or even northwest. We must have gone almost to Greenland, almost as far as Newfoundland. Never on a straight course, always zigzagging in daytime. And the Strathaiden that I was on was the Commodore ship. Every 5 minutes or so, a blast on the siren was the sound signal that every ship in the convoy would change course. And it rotated through maybe 45 or more degrees and sailed on the new course. And this went on all through daylight hours, every day, for days, almost weeks. At night time, they stopped the zigzagging because it was considered dangerous in case one of the ships forgot to zigzag, as it did once in daytime. And eventually we began to sail southwards, and the weather warmed up, because you can imagine that the North Atlantic in January was pretty pretty cold, and we were sailing first towards Newfoundland and then southwards, and it gradually warmed up. And our first sight of land was, I think, the Canary Islands, which was all lit up because Spain was neutral. And it was rather surprising that the convoy sailed through the Canary Islands, and a message could have been sent from the Canaries to the Germans about the size of the convoy and the direction of the convoy. And one would have thought that was a foolish thing to do. That's what happened. Part of the convoy split off and went into the Mediterranean by Gibraltar, and the rest sailed on southwards and stopped at Freetown in Sierra Leone. Nobody went ashore at Freetown, but some of the cunning natives came out in their dugout canoes trying to sell us interesting things or fruit or something. The idea of stopping at Freetown was really to stock up with water, because you can imagine that every ship had hundreds, thousands of troops, and the consumption of water must have been colossal. So we put on water, but no food at Freetown, and then sailed southwards again. When we got to the Cape, part of the convoy went to Cape Town, and the rest went on to Durban. When we got to Durban, it was a very moving reception. The remainder of the convoy, ships' engines were turned off. We were gliding in almost silently, and then we heard a singing voice. At the end of the quayside was a lady in white with a megaphone singing patriotic songs, Land of Hope and Glory, that had always been England. And after being at sea for nearly 6 weeks, that was really one of the most moving events of the war, as far as I was concerned, and as far as the troops were concerned. And they all crowded over to the starboard side of the ship, and the ship was actually leaning over with the weight of troops so that they could see and hear this this singing. And it said that this lady, I think she was an ex-opera singer, met every convoy that went into Durban throughout the war, even on the day that her own son was killed in Italy. She was still there. And there's a statue being erected to her in Durban recently, I understand. Well, in Durban, we had a few days to wait, and the local people were very good. They queued up with their cars to take us inland or to take us to a restaurant or to sit, change of scenery or something, and I was taken out to the Valley of a Thousand Hills by one family, and they treated me very well. But then we had to transfer to a troop ship called the Lancashire. That was the draft I was on, which was a very ancient First World War troop ship, very rusty, very dilapidated. The officers' cabins were occupied by ATS girls, also their territorials, so they issued me with a hammock, which I managed to sling on deck somewhere, not very satisfactorily, and we sailed northwards from Durban, calling at Tamatave in Madagascar, and then on to Mombasa, where we landed on the 12th of March. Well, in Mombasa, we had a few hours to wait for a train. Some people, I regret to say, got rather drunk. We were then put on a train to Nairobi, and some of the less sober ones were actually put on by military police, and we travelled from Mombasa to Nairobi, and the following day we were welcomed officially by Lord Francis Scott, an aunt of the present Duchess, Dowager Duchess of Gloucester, who considered himself to be the King's personal representative. And at that welcome I wore my fifth helmet that I've been issued with for the first and last time. When I left England, they gave me a lovely pith helmet to wear, which I knew all that once. We then went to a camp at Langata outside Nairobi on the edge of a game reserve. And as I'd been at sea, more or less confined for nearly 2 months, I decided to go for a walk, and I went, which I thought was a country walk. In fact, I was walking in a game reserve, And a few days later, one of the sentries nearby had been taken by a lion quite near to where I was walking. But nobody took the trouble to warn us that this was a dangerous country to be in. Well, at Langata, they gave us a little introduction to East Africa and a course of Swahili, which was the local native language in Kenya. And then I was posted to a battalion, which was called the 2nd 1st Battalion, King's African Rifles. Well, they were a Nyasaland battalion, speaking not Swahili, but Chinyanja, and they were posted, they were based not in Kenya, but in northern Rhodesia. So the journey from Nairobi to northern Rhodesia was really quite an event. Train to Kisumu and Lake Victoria, and on the way, the train stopped at a place called Nanyuki, where the first class passengers got out, went to the hotel at the station, and had a lovely dinner. When everybody had finished their dinner, they went back on the train, and the train went on to Kisumu. That's life in East Africa, in wartime. At Kisumu, I boarded a lake steamer, across Lake Victoria in a lake steamer, to Mwanza. A little bit seasick on the way. Lake Victoria's about the size of Ireland, and it took quite a long time, many hours. From Mwanza on Lake Victoria, I then took a train to Tabora, where we had to change, and I was then billeted in a guest house that had been built for the Kaiser, because Tanganyika was once a German colony. And they built a few guest houses, or rest houses, for the Kaiser to go on a hunting safari in about 1914. But he never got there because of the Great War. So I was billeted in the Kaiser's rest house in Tabora. From Tabora, train to Kigoma. At Kigoma, which was a port on Lake Tanganyika, I was able to go to Ujiji, a native town, which was exactly the place where Stanley, born in Denby, bathed in St. Asa, met Livingstone. And there was a little tablet there that says, under the mango tree which then stood on this site, Henry Morton Stanley met David Livingstone. That was put up by the Royal Geographical Society. So I followed Stanley's footsteps from Denby, St. Asa, to Ujiji in Central Africa. Well, from Kigoma on Lake Tanganyika, another lake steamer across to Albertville, the other side, west side. It's got another name now, I don't know what it is. Another train through the Belgian Congo to Kabala. Then a bumpy road journey, about 200 miles, to another place called Kambina. Another train to Elizabethville, still in the Congo. I think it's now called Lubumbashi or something like that, and then down to northern Rhodesia and south to Lusaka, which was the capital. But the total journey time there was about 10 days. Train, lorry, lake steamer. And having got to Lusaka and reported for duty, I was appointed battalion signals officer, but the Askari were being sent on leave to Nyasaland, because the battalion was destined for further things. They didn't quite know where, but they were going to be posted. So the Askari, that's the native soldiers, were sent on leave to Nyasaland. I hadn't got a job, so they said, you better go back to Nairobi for a PT course. This time, they sent me by air. So having had 10 days travel through Central Africa at the government's expense, I then flew back again where I came from, and I went on a PT and battle course at Gilgil, run by Jeff Dyson, who was actually an Olympic coach, and that was 3 to 4 weeks. Having finished that course, then I went back to Nairobi, and again by road south to Arusha in Tanganyika, then to Dodoma in central Tanganyika, back on a train. But we just missed the train under Doma, and they said, very sorry, next train 3 days' time. So we were stuck in Dodoma in Central Africa for 3 days, but the local ladies turned out and cooked meals for us and entertained us, and we had quite a nice time. And then train to Tabora, to Kigoma, across the Tanganyika, across the Congo, through the Congo, back to North Rhodesia again. So I've been travelling on and off through Africa for, I don't know, 2 months, 3 months perhaps, all at the government's expense. Nowadays people would pay thousands of pounds for that. Well, by that time the Askari were coming back from leave, and I was appointed battalion signals officer, because intelligence wasn't a bright spot in Africa in those days. There wasn't much in